Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Wally Lamb, whose most recent book is I'll Take You There. We'll also hear from Miriam Davis, author of The Axeman of New Orleans, and novelist Martin Poussin, author of Black Sheep Boy. Wally Lamb is a consistent New York Times bestselling author, and for good reason. His memorable characters and rich tales of family life strike a chord with his readers. In Wishin' and Hopin', he introduced us to a character named Felix Funicello, a cousin of the famous Annette. Felix is doing his best to get by as a fifth grader. But in his most recent book, I'll Take You There, we catch up with Felix as a 60-year-old in a kind of wonderful version of This Is Your Life. Local readers will have the chance to catch up with Wally Lamb himself in a few weeks at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. Wally Lamb, I'm so happy to welcome you back to The Reading Life.
Hey, good to be with you again, Susan, and also with your listeners. Thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, so Felix at 60. Now, that's an age when we take stock, isn't it?
Yes, and I'm 66 as we're talking, so I'm a little slow to start taking stock, but I think this most recent novel, that's exactly what I was doing.
Well, he's given an extraordinary opportunity to do so by some amazing women.
Yeah, a couple of them are deceased, right. And I wanted to tell a ghost story this time, but I also wanted to tell a story about Hollywood, and so I came across some information about a woman named Lois. And she was a real person, and she was a mover and shaker in the very early years of Hollywood. And before that, when the film industry, and I'm talking about silent films, was in New York, and then they went across the continent because the lighting was better in California. So this is Lois Weber, and I decided to give her ghost status and see if she could help Felix figure things out at this point in his life.
Now, you must have had a blast watching old movies and thinking about them for this.
Oh, I sure did. I'm a very early riser, so I get up at about 4 or 5 in the morning here in Connecticut, or, you know, we also have a place in New York, wherever. I could always pick up TCM and watch some vintage thing, and so I think that's what drew me into it. Also, I was drawn to it by a theater in New London, Connecticut, called The Guard, G-A-R-D-E. And The Guard almost becomes a character in the book. And that's how I first heard of Lois Weber. The manager said, oh, the first silent film we showed here, and it was also a vaudeville theater back in the 20s, they said the first film they showed here was a Lois Weber-directed film. So that's when I got on Google and saw that even though Cecil B. DeMille and all those guys are lauded still, those early movie producers, Lois was really quite accomplished. And probably partly because she was a woman, she sort of fades into the woodwork where the other ones become icons.
Well, I've seen pictures of The Guard, actually, and it looks so beautiful and elaborate and gorgeous. I mean, it looks like the time warp kind of place, you know? And then there's this moment in the book that I just love when Felix climbs on stage and looks out and goes, well, you know, I never thought what it looked like from here. I mean, that's a very sweet moment.
You know, that's actually based on my own life, because prior to this novel, as you mentioned, I wrote a little novel called Wishin' and Hopin', starring the same character, and it was made into a Lifetime film, and we had the premiere at the Guard Theater, of all places, and then afterwards I got up on the stage and took questions from the audience and so forth, and yeah, that was my first experience of what it's like to look out, almost like one of those old vaudeville performers. So yeah, it was pretty cool.
Coming home, man.
Yeah.
Now, these women from the past decide that Felix, you know, of modern men, as he is educable, which I love. I know many women who speak of men in those terms, but besides what they hope to show him, he's surrounded by interesting women. His ex-wife, Kat, is a great feminist. His daughter is a Gen Y writer. She's trying to make it in New York. And he grew up during this time of great change for women.
Sure did, yeah. As did I. Felix is about 4 or 5 years younger than I am, but I grew up with sisters, and then I went off to college, and that was when the civil rights and the women's movements were sort of burgeoning, and so I began to plug into the way things look like if you are not a guy. And so I kind of got my education, you know, from all that, and then back in 1999, I started working with incarcerated women at a prison in Connecticut, and boy, did they give me an education. So a lot of them struggle partly because of sexist policies about women who are convicted felons who are living an incarcerated life.
And you're still working with those women, aren't you?
I sure am. Yeah, we've done 2 books. I edit the books, but they write them. They write their own stories. Most of them want to deal with autobiographical pieces because, you know, they've arrived at a time and a place in their life where they never thought they would end up. And a lot of them aren't sure why and how they ended up in prison. And so they like to write reflective pieces. And then as they figure out their past, their lives, their pathologies in some cases, they get better. You know, I'm not a therapist by a long shot, but I'm a witness to the therapeutic value of not only their writing, but also their sharing their writing, and in some cases, their very deep and painful secrets with the other women. I wanted to take their voices beyond the prison walls and beyond the wires and so forth. So that's when we started publishing these anthologies of their work. And right now, I'm working on a third of those volumes.
Oh, great. Well, you've borne witness to women's lives so much in your fiction, and you've done it with such fidelity and clarity and sympathy. I mean, from the very beginning with Dolores and She's Come Undone to all the women in this new book. And there is one New Orleans woman in this book, and she is a talker.
Yeah, old Berna, yeah.
I liked her a lot.
I actually, she sort of pops up in the last third of the novel. And I'm not a planner. I'm not an outliner. I just have to show up my daily appointment at the computer or the notebook and see what's going to happen. So she just sort of appeared and demanded to be heard. So, yeah, she's another ghost character, but I had so much fun with her learning some of the dialect. I hope I did you New Orleanians right with some of her expressions and so forth.
But absolutely.
I did quite a bit of research. And then two of my kids live and work down in New Orleans, and so I would tap them about, you know, colloquialisms and so forth. I just love New Orleans. You know, we get down there as often as we can.
Now, you dedicate this novel for feminists everywhere of every era, which made me want to, well, first, thank you for that. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about coming to that dedication, about what feminism means to you as a man living through this time.
Well, I was working with an editor who said to me one day, you know, women, young women, millennial women are, you know, they're different than the feminists who came up in the 70s. And I got curious about that, and so I started reading things by writers who call themselves post-feminists. And I think it's just maybe 21st century version of feminism. So then that was how Felix's daughter, Eliza, was born, as in the story. And as you mentioned, she's a writer sort of in New York, and, you know, women are putting these, I learned the term chicken cutlets, which I didn't know, where they're feminists, but they're putting things in their bras to make themselves a little bit more endowed and that kind of thing. And so in some ways, whereas when I was coming of age, the women who were feminists were burning their bras and letting their armpit hair grow out and that kind of thing. But these are different kinds of feminists. But as, you know, at least in my understanding, in my research, they are more plugged into social media, and they're more concerned with global applications of feminism, not just things that are happening in America and the fight for equality with things like the Equal Rights Amendment and that kind of thing.
Well, so, I love those conversations with Felix and Eliza talking about things. They were great.
Okay.
You know, you bring all this up and it makes me realize I've been reading you for 20 years, Wally. Jeez.
It's a little scary, yeah.
It's great, though. Thank you.
She's Come Undone, you know, it got a lot of attention when Oprah picked it in 1997 for her book club. But in actuality, that novel had come out 5 years earlier. So,
longer than that.
Published in 1992. So this year it is having its 25th birthday. So Dolores Price and I have been around for a long time.
All right. Well, then I've been reading you for 25 years. I'm very happy to say.
Well, you know, I will never forget. I thank you for this every time I talk to you. But you came up in your review of the book with the most beautiful description of that hard-to-describe novel when you said, this is a story about accepting the family you were given and finding the family you need. And, you know, I could not have said it better. You know, it took me 600 pages to say the same thing, but you had it in a sentence. You were a little bit of a show-off there, Susan.
Well, I was happy to be for that book, let me tell you. Oh, we've been talking with Wally Lamb, whose new novel is I'll Take You There. He'll be conducting a masterclass on creating memorable characters Friday, March 24th at 10:30 at the Historic New Orleans Collection. And then he'll appear on a panel, Who Are These People? Writing About Family, Saturday, March 25th at 1 at the Hotel Monteleone. For more information, check out TennesseeWilliams.net. Wally, thank you so much. See you soon.
Always fun to talk to you, Susan. Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Miriam Davis is the author of Dame Kathleen Kenyon, a biography of the most important female archaeologist of the 20th century. In her second book, she's turned to a story that has long preoccupied New Orleanians. It's called The Axeman of New Orleans, The True Story. She's speaking to us today from her home in Montgomery, Alabama. Miriam Davis, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
This is a gory story, and it's inspired so much interest over the years in so many different forms, hasn't it?
Uh-huh. I think it's just so spooky that it attracts a certain type.
So what made you think the time was right for this book? I know that you fessed up to a fascination with serial killers that you and your brother share.
Yeah, and, you know, as I said in the book, I had just sort of started playing on Google, looking for information about the Axeman, mostly, you know, to procrastinate. And I realized there were these questions that had not been answered that I thought could be answered. I really tumbled to the fact that nobody had really researched it properly. But yet, if you Google the Axeman of New Orleans, you'll find lots of sites that mention it. So I thought, well, maybe people would be interested in, you know, the real story.
And you do answer one of my burning questions, which is, how did he know there would always be an axe when he needed one? I mean,
well, this was a time when there was no central heating, and people cooked with a wood-burning stove. So everybody had an axe.
So he always knew where to look for it, and he found it when he needed it. It was just shocking to me. So tell us a little bit about him, for those who don't know, about this killing rampage of his, how long it lasted, where it happened, and kind of what you knew going into this story.
Well, going into the story, I knew about one of the most famous attacks in 1918 on a couple called the Maggio couple, Joe and Catherine Maggio. And that was a very, very bloody murder. And then over the next 18 months, there were several other attacks and several other murders. But in what Talent wrote and what other writers wrote, there were rumors of a possible earlier series of killings. And I went back and I found, and I believe this is the same person, is that someone who they call the Cleaver started attacking the same sort of victim, Italian grocers, in 1910 and then 1911. It was only the third attack in 1911 that he had the first fatality. He killed a grocer named Joe Davy. And then he disappears. The murderer disappears for 6 years or so. And he reappears not with the Maggio in May of 1918, but in December of 1917, he attacked a grocer named Angelina and injured him but didn't kill him. And that is what starts that second series of attacks, from 1917 to 1919. And my theory is that he switched from a cleaver, which he stole and was carrying around, to an axe simply because he knew he wouldn't have to take a weapon to the scene, that he could be pretty sure that he'd find a weapon there, and he wouldn't have to take it away and risk being caught walking the streets with a bloody weapon.
So in addition to the Googling and reading Robert Tell and all these things, what sort of things did you do in New Orleans to kind of retrace his steps?
Well, at the time, there were three, sometimes four newspapers in New Orleans. And at the time, newspapers printed stuff, details, that they'd never be allowed to print today. So the newspaper accounts are much more detailed than you'd find in newspapers today. There are also homicide records. There are coroner's reports. There are arrest reports. So there are lots of little nuggets of information there.
Well, one of the things that fascinates me about this book is the way you have to evoke the history of the time. You know, like police procedures were very primitive. And you see a change in what people knew to do over time in a crime scene.
Right. Right. And for example, it's only towards the end of my story that fingerprinting is even available in New Orleans. And they could fingerprint the crime scene, but they didn't have any sort of database to run it through. So fingerprints were only useful if you had an actual suspect to check their fingerprints. They didn't have a lot in the way of technology.
And also so much infrastructure even then was such a problem, because if this family would call for help, you know, if someone would run into the street and they would try and fetch an ambulance, sometimes the ambulances couldn't even get down the roads to the houses.
Right. This was a time when a lot of New Orleans streets weren't paved. And a lot of what's now New Orleans proper, it was almost countryside. And there were cows and chickens and all sorts of things. You had these very bumpy roads, which could sometimes be very muddy. In one case, you know, the ambulance got stuck. So, you know, they were lucky that they had Charity Hospital, which was a very good hospital for the time. And they were lucky they even had an ambulance, but it couldn't get everywhere fast. I mean, there was no 911.
And they were lucky they had neighbors who would come to rushing to their aid, too, I thought.
Yes.
Now, one of the things I really wanted to ask you about is, what was it like for you to write this book? What did it do to advance your journey as a writer? I mean, because on the one hand, you're spending lots of time going into great and terrible detail about these events that is truly disturbing. And yet, at the same time, you have to stand back and look over the big picture and try and connect the dots. So what did you learn about writing a book like this as you did it?
It was very different from other books or kinds of things that I had written. I was trained as a historian. I got a PhD in history. And you're trained in a certain way. And you're not necessarily trained to be the most riveting writer. So one of the things that was a real challenge for me was to change my writing style, to find a different voice, and to try to be as novelistic as possible while at the same time staying true to the facts. And I would say that for me was like one of the hardest things. And sometimes what I would do when I would feel like I wasn't quite getting it, I would sit down for 20 or 30 minutes and I would read somebody like Eric Larson or Lauren Hillenbrand in an effort to try to get a sense of that kind of storytelling style.
Well, I swear it gave me nightmares. Did you ever have bad dreams about this book when you were writing it?
No, I didn't. When I wrote the book about the archaeologist, occasionally I would get an email from somebody who read it and was interested in her or, you know, where she dug, and would ask me a question. And my husband said, well, that was all very well, but he was a little worried about the kind of people who might read this book and then try to get in touch with me.
So true. Oh, well, you never know, because this is a case that's still preoccupying people every day, so I'm sure you're going to have a big audience for it.
I hope so. That'd be nice.
Oh, well, thanks. We've been talking with historian Miriam Davis, whose new book is The Axeman of New Orleans, The True Story. She'll be appearing at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, speaking at 10 a.m. Saturday at Muriel's Jackson Square on a panel, Getting at the Real Story, Creating Compelling Nonfiction. Check out TennesseeWilliams.net for the complete schedule. Miriam, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Try not to breathe as we're playing the X-Men's chess. See you again.
Martin Poussin is one of my favorite Louisiana writers, from his very first novel, No Place Louisiana, to his poetry collection, Sugar, and now the second novel, Black Sheep Boy, an unforgettable novel and stories about growing up gay in French Acadiana. We're speaking to Martin today from his home in Los Angeles, California, where he teaches at the University of California, Northridge. Martin Poussin, I'm so happy to talk to you again.
Susan, I am thrilled. Thank you so much.
Well, I loved this book. It's so vivid and fairy tale-like in some ways, drawing on folklore from our region, but it's so brutally realistic in other ways.
Thank you, Susan. The word brutal is probably perfect because I wanted to capture the sense of a culture that did have incited an awful history of violence, and that violence causes, I think, a kind of polarity in the songwriting, in the storytelling, in the region, so that there's a lot of high, high, high hilarity, outrageousness in the jokes and in the songs. And in the very same joke, in the very same song, there's often an extraordinary act of violence, of, you know, extreme tragedy. And I wanted this book to swing along with the culture from extreme to extreme.
So much of this book is about exile, beginning with your mention of the Grand Derangement, exile from home, exile from family. And that's often the case in gay life, isn't it, that you have to leave home to find another family, and that sometimes you feel an exile in your own country even.
Yes, exactly. You're right. In an odd way, the book becomes a story of two kinds of exile and two kinds of queerness. There's the sexual queerness of the boy, but there's also the cultural queerness of Cajuns in Acadiana, who themselves, of course, were the products of a mass diaspora, the largest mass deportation in the Western Hemisphere, a really horrible trauma, largely a forgotten chapter in pre-revolutionary U.S. history. And that Grand Derangement, I think, is transliterated to great upheaval, but I always understood it as truly a derangement, you know, and there are all these stories of madness and insanity and loss and abandonment. Of course, the wild mythic tale of Evangeline is based on two actual figures. So I think that is at the root of Acadiana. And then as a paradox, when I was growing up, most Cajuns actually never went more than, you know, 25 miles from their birthplace. And there's a long tradition of sort of staying put, staying rooted, staying in place that is contrary to the history of the people. You know, people who had been without borders and people who had moved around very freely suddenly were not, because they were trying to hold on to what they had left of that culture. And then up from this grows this queer boy who is rejected by all of, you know, his culture, his family, for being the outsider that he is when they themselves were outsiders. So, you know, subordinated people often turn around and subordinate others, and he faces this dilemma in this, you know, deeply rooted place in which he grows up. His understanding is the only way out is through it. So he's got to go through the whole trauma of growing up queer in that land, but he can only conceive of finding a home outside of the place in which he grows up. So yes, exile, the queer diaspora, is very parallel to the Cajun diaspora. The diaspora of the Acadianas and the Grand Derangement is a backdrop for his own kind of derangement and eventual exile.
We've been talking with Martin Poussin, whose most recent novel and stories is The Brilliant Black Sheep Boy. You can meet him when he comes to New Orleans for the Saints and Sinners Literary Festival, March 24th through 26th. For more information, go to sasfest.org. Martin, thank you so much.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Poet Melissa Dickey reads from and signs her new book, Dragons, Tuesday, March 14th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Jim Dees signs The Statue and the Fury, A Year of Art, Race, Music, and Cocktails, Wednesday, March 15th at 6 at Octavia Books. Gwen Tompkins signs A Life in Jazz by Danny Barker, Wednesday, March 15th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. The Amistad Research Center presents Bernice McFadden, winner winner of the 2017 NAACP Black Image Award for Outstanding Literary Work in Fiction, in a dialogue with 2015 Lambda Award winner for fiction, Alexis DeVoe. They'll be discussing Black women writing and the imagination of American culture, Thursday, March 16th at 6:30 at the Ashe Cultural Arts Center. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses Henry James, The Turn of the Screw, Saturday, March 18th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Todd Michael St. Pierre signs his Chicory and Rue, The Creole Mouse and the Cajun Mouse, Saturday, March 18th at 10:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. Erica Spindler presents 25 Years, 35 Books, A Writer's Tale, Saturday, March 18th at 11 a.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. That's part of the regularly scheduled meeting of the Southeast Louisiana chapter of the Romance Writers of America. Whitney Stewart signs A Catfish Tale and Meditation is an Open Sky, Mindfulness for Kids, and conducts a meditation class for kids aged 4 to 7, Saturday, March 18th at 3 at the French Library. Bo Boudreau signs his book of poems, Rapunzel's Braids, Monday, March 20th at 6 at the Garden District Bookshop. Casey Stewart discusses The Great Hunger and the Ethnic Cleansing of Ireland in the 19th Century, Monday, March 20th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. This is part of the regularly scheduled monthly meeting of the Genealogical Research Society of New Orleans, open to the public. Troy Lynn Ball signs Pure Heart, A Spirited Tale of Grace, Grit, and Whiskey, Tuesday, March 21st at 6 at Octavia Books. Ari Herstand discusses and signs How to Make It in the New Music Business, Practical Tips on Building a Loyal Following and Making a Living as a Musician, Tuesday, March 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And later on in March, get ready for the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, March 22nd through 26th, with special guests Jamie Attenberg, Roy Blunt Jr., Rick Bragg, Patricia Bosworth, Robert Olin Butler, Dick Cavett, Amy Dickinson, Wally Lamb, and many others. Masterclasses start on March 23rd, so sign up for limited admission events with some of your favorite writers. For more information, check out TennesseeWilliams.net. The schedule is online now. Saints and Sinners, the festival for LGBT writers and readers, takes place March 24th through 26th. Check out sasfest.org for info. Also coming up, for fans of James Lee Burke's fiction, check out DaveRobichaudLiteraryFestival.com for complete schedule of events, March 31st through April 2nd in New Iberia. There will be tours, music, a symposium and book fair, cooking demos, and a 5K run. And One Book, One New Orleans has made its choice for the coming year for the Citywide Reading Initiative. It is the fine poetry collection Counting Descent by New Orleans native Clint Smith. Also coming up, the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities celebrates its annual Bright Lights Award dinner, honoring Humanist of the Year William Joyce, as well as many others, Thursday, April 13th at 7 at the Shaw Center in Baton Rouge. Check out leh.org for tickets. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.